At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
CBD Revolution. The world is discovering CBD and its potential for numerous health benefits. Hemfusion Wellness is the premier company looking at CBD with a whole food perspective. For the highest quality CBD oils and products for stress, sleep, energy, and topicals, it's Hemfusion. This CBD Revolution highlight has been brought to you by Hemfusion Wellness, U.S. trading symbol CBDHF, and in Canada, CBD.U. Web address, hempfusion.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio and Tom Jossen. They are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, watching the vast canvas of the Ummah from the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. We begin, however, with Tom's remarks before the Senate Armed Services Committee some days past about after the American withdrawal, after the ISAF withdrawal, after right now NATO having no good ears or eyes inside the region, what is next? And that involves a variety of possibilities. Tom, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. Your testimony begins with what we have now in Afghanistan is what we've had before, but it's now revealed without American interference. We have Al-Qaeda, we have ISIS, and we have an awakened Taliban recruiting across the region. First of all, your remarks about Al-Qaeda, how were they greeted by the Senate Armed Services Committee? Are they at least informed that Al-Qaeda never left the region? Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, John. You know, it was kind of interesting testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee. I didn't find any disagreement among Democrats or Republicans that Al-Qaeda has been there all along. Nobody seemed to be surprised by that. Nobody seemed to disagree with it. You know, basically going in, I had my point of my testimony was to make really two broad arguments. The first was that U.S. military leadership and really the political leadership of America didn't understand the insurgency or the status of the insurgency. And you remember that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, has been going around, General Milley has been going around saying that the Afghan government fell in 11 days. And this was repeated by some of the senators who were there. But, you know, John, we've talked about this so many times. We've been following Bill's work, you know, with his map that he was documenting meticulously for so long. You know that it didn't fall in 11 days. You know that there was a much longer plan in motion here. And really the final offensive was really 3.5 months from May 1st to mid-August. So the first point was that basically nobody who was a decision maker here, a policy maker here, really understood the insurgency. And that's really scandalous. The second thing is that just as they didn't understand the insurgency, they didn't understand the insurgents. So you hear some of the top leadership now saying that Al-Qaeda is going to be reconstituted or they're going to make a comeback in Afghanistan. And surely some senior Al-Qaeda leaders are going to make their way back to Afghanistan. Some fighters are going to relocate to Afghanistan. But that was the second point of my testimony, was that Al-Qaeda was there all along. And not only were they there all along, they helped the Taliban win the war.
The ISIS presence was a great concern to the American media towards the close of the American withdrawal. ISIS was blamed for the suicide vest attack on Afghan and American around the airport, leading to the death of 13. Was the committee and its staff concerned about that attack, about ISIS and about ISIS's relationship?
I mean, certainly they were. And I mean, ISIS has an ongoing presence in Afghanistan. We've seen that they've had some small-scale attacks on Taliban convoys using improvised explosive devices, and they've now been attacking mosques, which are sort of low-hanging fruit, easy civilian targets for ISIS to go hit. And certainly ISIS posed a threat to the U.S. presence in Afghanistan right through the very end there, as we saw. I just think that when you look at the broader picture, the U.S. leadership, again, one of the things that happened here was they became myopically obsessed with ISIS as the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the unbroken Taliban Al-Qaeda axis was taking over the country. And this goes to show sort of the myopia that set in within the American political and military leadership on this war. But ISIS is still there. They still have a presence. You know, a lot of times the ISIS presence is really an offshoot from the Taliban Al-Qaeda. You know, the earliest ISIS commanders were really defectors, guys who were upset with the chain of command within their existing organizations for one reason or another. You're going to see ISIS, you know, is going to have a lingering presence in Afghanistan for sure, and they have a presence in Pakistan. But, you know, at no point in time were they able to take over the country the way the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were. And, you know, a lot of the analysis that we're seeing basically is downplaying the fact that these insurgents, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, were the master insurgents who won the war at the expense of the terrorists. You know, ISIS is really more of a limited terrorist organization. It's able to conduct terrorist operations. And this is an important point, John, because what I found in testifying and talking to people in the leadership is they don't understand that insurgents are basically an evolved form of terrorists, right? The terrorists are sort of a lesser species on the scale of political violence than the insurgents are. And yet I've even seen this with people that we, Bill and I know, they seem to have it flipped in their head. They think that the insurgents are the lesser species, which is not the case.
An additional point before the Congress was Pakistan. Pakistan's contribution to the Taliban victory and Pakistan's ongoing relationship with the Taliban. Your understanding, does the Senate Armed Services Committee see that Pakistan is an inconstant threat and that the stability in the region cannot be achieved by empowering a state such as Pakistan?
You know, I don't think anybody pushed back at the Senate Armed Services Committee about my comments about Pakistan. Obviously, everybody knows they sponsored and harbored the Taliban leadership and facilitation networks and parts of Al-Qaeda even, and helped them win the war. And this external sanctuary from Afghanistan south in Pakistan was a big deal for the insurgents. You know, John, I'll point out that I also testified last week for the Senate Banking Committee, which we have to post that testimony at Longword Journal as well. And one of the things I figured out while doing the research for that testimony was that the U.S. gave Pakistan since 2001 more than $30 billion in military assistance aid and military reimbursements. And the point I used there was that did not provide the U.S. with leverage over the Pakistani state when it came to harboring the very same actors who were targeting Americans and Afghans in Afghanistan. And the reason why I brought that up with Senate Banking Committee was that, you know, you're seeing in Washington now this idea that U.S. can have leverage over the Taliban with humanitarian aid and assistance. And I made two points on that. One, the U.S. hasn't had any leverage over the Taliban in 25 years. We have a quarter of a century of history here. There's no reason to think that at any point in time America had leverage over the Taliban, and there's no reason to think they do now. And two, this more than $30 billion in aid, which is certainly more than the Taliban's going to receive, didn't provide the U.S. with leverage over the Pakistani state. So I think that this is, just trying to debunk this idea that Washington has a hand to play here going forward.
And in general, Tom, would you say that the Senate Armed Services Committee presented staff and senators an informed view of the region as unstable and threatening going forward, or did they treat this region as a rearview mirror, no longer our major concern?
You know, I don't think they put it in the rearview mirror. I think that. You know, that there was still an expressing ongoing concern. But I don't know how much anybody really, was willing to do anything about it. That's the bottom line. And I think we've reached a point where America lost this war. And so now you have people just, you know, want to be on the record as saying that there is an ongoing threat still from the region, but nobody really knows how to handle it.
We turn to how to handle it because the presenting case right now is that the Taliban is organizing a government. And Bill, just quickly, you have an item about the Taliban Minister of Interior issuing passports, Afghan passports. Your understanding, these passports, are they to be acknowledged when the members of the Taliban travel? Are they going to issue passports to unknowns, for example, allowing bad actors access to airlines, to airports and capitals that heretofore would have blocked them?
Hello, John. Yes. So those are the questions, right? How will these passports be treated by countries outside of Afghanistan, by where the Taliban and others will travel? So the passports are being issued by Sirajuddin Haqqani, who runs the Interior Ministry. And of course, he's a, you know, an Al-Qaeda leader. He's the deputy emir of the Taliban. He's one of the most powerful Taliban leaders with close ties to Al-Qaeda, one of many Taliban leaders as such. And he, again, you know, I mean, I'm stating the obvious here now, but he now has the power to issue passports to basically to whoever he wants. Think about that, you know, post September 11th, the travel of foreign jihadists. This is something to be monitored and to be concerned about. Now, today, you have a terrorist state issuing passports for people to travel. Now, you could argue, well, that's fine. Any passports issued after a certain date, they should be tracked and whatnot. But they have access to all of the passport material from the previous Afghan government. They could backdate information. They could do anything they want. They have the tools of the state to issue official documents. And would Siraj Haqqani issue passports to members of Al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorist groups? I certainly wouldn't put it past them. They've relied on them to help conquer Afghanistan. And there's going to be payback. This is something I don't think, you know, I don't think this is understood whatsoever within the U.S. government, within U.S. national security establishment. I know there's individuals working these issues who are very concerned, but I don't think our policymakers, our politicians have grasped the significance of the Taliban takeover. They just see it as a bad thing, as something unwanted. But I really don't think they understand the gravity that you have a terrorist state that is ready, willing, and able to support foreign terrorists.
I'm speaking to Bill Rajo and Tom Jostin. They are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They keep the Long War Journal, a chronology and analysis of the vast Ummah. And we're concentrating on Afghanistan because it's going through transformations that are puzzling and non-transparent. The U.S. does not have good eyes and ears in the region, I'm told, I read. So when we come back, what does that mean about stability going forward, especially organizations that are now attracted to basing in Afghanistan, in the terror state, question mark? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Chances are, you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info, and if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.